Good evening and welcome. Before I introduce our Rabbi Angel in a few minutes, just want to thank Avram Sharon Blumenthal for sponsoring this evening. The Avram and Sharon for a number of years already have been sponsoring various scholars, sometimes for Shabbos, sometimes for weekends, sometimes for weeknights, sometimes Friday nights, sometimes both. And I want to do something special for, again, the Yahrzeit, which Avram will talk about in a couple of minutes, just for a couple of minutes. And so this is special for many reasons. Rabbi Angel, of course, is well known to talk about Tanakh, and this is, maybe it is, maybe it isn't about Tanakh, but we'll leave that to Rabbi Angel to explain his theories, which are very, very compelling. But before further ado, just please be attention to Tavi Zunzo for a few minutes.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming this for this special evening. It's a very meaningful event for my family and me. What better way to commemorate a Yahrzeit than with a room full of family, friends, and community? I am confident that you will gain from Rabbi Angel's lecture and scholarly insight. His first three shiurim were very well received. About 20 years ago, I attended a global meeting for the company I worked for in London. And after spending a week with the managers from the other offices, which they came from Asia and Europe, I never forgot what our British host said the last day of our meeting. When an Englishman leaves a place, he always says goodbye. After thinking about what he said and how polite a gesture like that is, I thought about it on a deeper level, and the thought that came to my mind was, but in the Jewish tradition, we never say goodbye. We have Yisker, we have Kaddish, we have Yahrzeit. The Hebrew month of Kislev is the ninth of 12 months of the Hebrew calendar. In this month, Hanukkah begins on the 25th of Kislev, of which Jews throughout the world celebrate. On a more personal level, it is also the month in which my family commemorates the Yahrzeit of a few special Nishamot. My father's oldest sister, my Aunt Sadie Berner's Yahrzeit, falls on the 23rd of Kislev. My father's oldest brother, Isidore Blumenthal, is actually today, the 14th of Kislev. And my grandfather, Chaim Tannenbaum's Yahrzeit, was this past week. My father, Baruch Ben Yosef, his Yahrzeit is the second day of Hanukkah this year. It's the day after Thanksgiving. I mention these individuals because they all live lives full of chesed and kindness and were followers of the teachings of the Torah. The name Kislev is derived from the word kesel, which means security and trust. They also lived lives that included those characteristics. Allow me a few minutes to mention a few brief reminiscences of the many I have of them. My Aunt Sadie, who was the first in the family to intermarry, she married a Glitziana, always showed kindness and generosity to me. As a little boy, and even when I got older, when my parents would vacation, she would watch me and make sure I had a meal and where to go for Shabbos. She even let me borrow Uncle Murray's car if I needed to go out when my father's car wasn't available. Every year, I remember getting a birthday card from Aunt Sadie. My Uncle Isidore, besides being my father's oldest brother, was my father's business partner for over 50 years. It was a unique relationship, almost like father and son. My uncle was 10 years older. But the devotion, trust, and commitment they had for each other was unprecedented. They, along with another uncle, George Blumenthal, built the business that still exists today. I'm convinced that the success and durability of that entity was due to a Jewish concept that my father and uncles practiced and we usually don't find in business managerial textbooks. It's called Shalom Bayis. One day, 9 years ago, I took my parents to see this uncle when he was in failing health, and we were about to leave his home. He asked me to bring my father back to the room. They embraced and both broke down. But I heard my father thank him for being always there for him. But they never said goodbye. 2 weeks later, this uncle passed away at the age of 94. My maternal grandfather, Chaim ben Avraham Yitzchak, came to this country in 1917 from a village in the province of Grodno, Russia, on the border with Poland. This shtetl was situated between Brisk and Pinsk. His family ran away from anti-Semitism and poverty. My grandfather was also a landsman of the famous opera singer Jan Pius. Jan's father, whose family name was Perlmuth, was from the same shtetl in Europe, belonged to the same society and shul called the Haridets. They davened together every Shabbos on the Lower East Side. In 1922, my grandfather met my grandmother, and in that same year, he opened his bakery called Tannenbaum's Bakery at 181 Housen Street, next door to Benny's Cheese Store and Russ and Daughter's Appetizing. The Tannenbaum family was actively involved in the Haridetz Shul and fulfilled wholeheartedly the Talmudical adage, "Im ein Kemach, ein Torah." If there's no flour, there's no Torah. The shul never lacked for a kiddush as long as my grandfather was there. He also donated baking goods to Rav Moshe Feinstein's yeshiva, MTJ, and always made himself available to the Feinstein family if they needed anything. In 1970, after selling his store and retiring from 50 years of running the bakery, my grandmother, grandfather, and my brother Alan traveled to Israel for the first time to see the homeland for the Jewish people. When they returned from the visit, my brother Alan said it was the highlight of my grandfather's life. They spent Yom Kippur on kibbutz near Etzion, and at the request of the group tour leader, my grandfather was asked to say the Kaddish at Yad Vashem. Hanukkah is the only holiday in the Jewish calendar which stands, and hence it connects 2 months, Kislev and Tevet. My sons have had the privilege of growing up with two sets of grandparents, connecting three generations. This is a rare occurrence for those who were born and raised during the early part of the 1900s. Most people from that era didn't even remember a grandparent. My father loved to share stories with the boys and his army days, donating his army equipment to relatives who were fighting for the state of Israel. And in the early days, he would tell them stories of the early days of the family business, which he played an integral part in. Particularly, my son Chaim always remembers the economic sacrifices the family had to make that my father would say during the Great Depression, and they were also affected by the experiences of World War II. My father would tell him about difficulties of keeping the business closed on Shabbos and Yom Tov, how all his siblings had to come down to Orchard Street to work in the store. Of all the accomplishments he had in his business career, the fact that the business was closed on Shabbos and Yom Tov and the family was strictly Shomer Shabbos, that was the one thing he was the most proud of. There was one particular characteristic that my father was consistent, and I admired that he had that, and that was his sense of loyalty. He always allowed his own interest to take second place to another person or cause. He was always part of something bigger than himself. His loyalty to family, the military service during World War II, the family business, the community he lived in, and the shul in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, where I grew up. My father also grew up in that house. My father will continue to be remembered by his children and his grandchildren. We thank Hashem for allowing him some more time with us so he could add great-grandfather to his title before passing away at the age of 90. I believe that stories are an effective way of communicating a family culture and values. It's also a means of never saying goodbye. We carry with us a unique commodity, a vivid consciousness of our past. Life is understood by looking back, but must be lived forward. When all is said and done, we are still here teaching our descendants what a family's culture and values are like, giving them an incentive to build connections among relatives, our bridge from the past to the future. I want to thank Avi and Ellen Freilich for encouraging me to sponsor this evening and arranging the speaker series that we have all enjoyed to date, and look forward to this evening's lecture as well. Mazel tov to Avi and Ellen for being the honorees at tomorrow night's Sederot Yeshiva dinner. Both of you continue to reflect the life of committed Jews and through your acts of kindness and generosity to all who come in contact with you. May you continue to inspire all of us by example. And Rabbi Hochberg, for his guidance and being there as a sounding board for some of my thoughts. But more important than that, the dedication and passion you have for the members of this community and their life cycle events. You and the Rebbetzin have been role models and played such a vital role in our functioning as a community of Shalom Bayis. I want to give special birthday greetings to my sister-in-law Janice. And next week, I have an aunt. Her name is Ann Conchi, who will be celebrating her 102nd birthday. Thank you for listening to these personal reminiscences. You are all welcome to partake in the refreshments at the back of the room after the lecture. And many thanks to Marty Pasternak for arranging the collation. Thank you.
Thank you.
So now you know, if you speak beforehand, you pay by giving food afterwards. That was not a deal, but this is there will be refreshments afterwards. I would like to take the opportunity also to thank Avi, really, for arranging the entire series, to thank Marty Pasternak and Simcha Sama for setting up the refreshments, and also to thank the sponsors, the earlier sponsors, the Shrivers, the Pels, Villers, and Kramers, for sponsoring the Tanakh series, and of course, again, Avram and Sharon for sponsoring this evening. Just before Rabbi Angel finishes the series for this fall, I just want to make one comment to try and focus our attention. And I do so by talking a little bit about Rabbi Angel. In his bio as National Scholar of the Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals, teaches Tanakh, etc., as I described in previous. He wrote 10 books, most recently, author and editor of 10 books, most recently, Vision from the Prophet, Counsel from the Elders, A Servant of Vim, and Ketuvim. So, what I'd like to point out is the following. Those of us who attended, the more of the lectures who attended, some of the more appreciate this as a reality, is that we look at Tanakh, whether it's Torah, Nevi'im, or Ketuvim, a certain way when we're growing up. We may continue to look at it the same way. We may even study our own and still be, if you will, held back by preconceived notions, or we can be open to trying to learn Tanakh a new way, taking, if you will, what Chazal said, what others have put into it, and really incorporating that and help us understand that every single sentence, every single word of Tanakh is of value and worth studying. And we've learned a lot from Rabbi Angel so far about three Sfarim of Ketuvim. We learned, I'm sure, this evening about Chanukah, and as we approach Chanukah soon. But I hope that in addition to all the actual content that we learn and perhaps methodology we learn, is we learn that Tanakh is, and so is Gemara for that matter, but Tanakh is the focus, if you will, of the series, is something that we should not say, well, we read it and we pass it and we know it or we don't know it and we just make jokes about it because the men like aren't supposed to know Tanakh, theoretically. Rabbi Angel proved that to be a falsehood. And women certainly are not more or less chayav to learn Tanakh, and probably not less, more or less chayav, whether mitzvah or not mitzvah. We're all mechuyav to learn all of the Torah to make us better, all of the Hashem and all of the Hashem. And I think all of that together, if you will, is what Rabbi Angel has given us over the past 3 weeks, and I anticipate also over the next hour. For that, we thank Rabbi Angel very much, and you should be masliach all around the country, and hopefully we'll have you back here soon as well. Rabbi Angel.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Hochberg. Thank you all for coming, and of course, may all of the Blumenthal relatives be, the memory of them be a blessing. Thank you very much for sponsoring the event. It feels like a very long time since we've all been together, doesn't it? I was so in this rhythm of, you know, every week coming out, it was part of the thing, and then 3 weeks go by, and other things happen, and all of a sudden, oh my goodness, I'm coming back again. It's very exciting to be back. It's also very weird, when the series started, we were just coming out of the Chagim, and I think that my head was still very much there. I imagine that many of your heads were in a similar place. And now Chanukah is like coming. So weird. I'm going to talk about Chanukah tonight, but it's strange that it's actually timely. But the weirdest thing for me, and for this I feel very, very out of sorts, is I don't have a Tanakh here. Mm-hmm. Do you know how unusual that is for me? It's crazy. Especially in a series that's supposed to be a Tanakh series. Here I am coming here, but I have no book in front of me. I just have notes, and that's of course because we don't have any text. for Chanukah, and that drives rabbis crazy. I mean, I'm sure Rabbi Hochberg knows every year you struggle to come up with ideas. So all the other Chagim, we have so many rich texts in Tanakh and then Chazal to go for. Whereas for Chanukah, you have a couple of dots in Masechet Shabbat. Good luck. There's a book called Ner Lameah. What's Ner Lameah? The question that every rabbi has to ask every 3 or 4 years in the sermon, just because of lack of material. It's not the rabbi's fault, trust me. After all, if they found one day's worth of oil, then the miracle part was only 7 days, right? So why don't we have a 7-day holiday? Okay, so great question. That's just about all we got going for us. And as a result, what's Ner Lameah? It's a compilation of 100 rabbinic answers to the question. Now, that means that lots of rabbis had sermons to give, and so they had to come up with answers. It also means that none of us know the answer, right? If you have 100, if you have 100 different answers, you could easily come up with 400 more. But see, that only begs the question of why I don't have a book in front of me. After all, the Maccabees and their followers wrote books, 4 books of the Maccabees, chapters and verses, and they obviously had in mind that these books should be included in Tanakh. That I should have been able to bring a Tanakh, and the books of the Maccabees would be there, and I'd say, okay, everybody, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Dalet, let's look at it together, let's see what Rashi has to say, where Chazal. Nothing doing, right? Chazal never mentioned the books of the Maccabees. Never, 0 times in all of Shas. You never even know that there are books of the Maccabees. Why not? There's some really good stories in there. I learned some of them in my children's books as a kid, and I'm sure at some point I'll have to start reading some of these to my daughters also, I'm sure with heavy, heavy censorship until they learn how to read and they'll realize that daddy is censoring yet again. But in the meantime, I have a couple of years to worry about that. Why didn't the books of the Maccabees make it? Why don't we have a text to read on Chanukah from Tanakh itself? So one answer that's pretty easy is that, yes, the Maccabees were very religious and they did some wonderful things, hence holiday that we like. Bad news is that their grandchildren already became Hellenists. They became part of the problem and they persecuted the very rabbis that their grandparents used to support. Okay, so Chazal didn't like that very much. Goodbye. We don't like the Maccabees, we don't want their books. That's a very easy answer, a very simple explanation. But for the first time a few years ago, I admit that I had a Yetzer Hara, since nobody ever let me look at the books of the Maccabees in Yeshiva Day School, right? We never heard of them. So I decided, let's just read them and see what's actually in there. And see what they have to say and what they don't have to say, and do they kind of fit into the way Chazal and the way later layers of rabbinic Chanukah fit into play, or do they have their own agenda? Curious stuff when you open up the books of the Maccabees. If you look at source number 1, the Maccabees, of course, were Kohanim, right? So what we often learn about in Yeshiva is, well, they were Kohanim, but they were kings, and kings are supposed to be from Malchut Beit David, and that's a really interesting question. Okay, I think it is a really interesting question. But as far as the Maccabees were concerned, they had a very different self-perception, at least from the get-go. Source number 1, right at the beginning of the first book of Maccabees, this is all from the Anchor Bible translation by Jonathan Goldstein, which was published back in the 70s. When he had finished uttering these words, a Jewish man came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice upon the altar in Modi'in, in accordance with the king's decree. The king had decreed that Jews should bring sacrifices to their pagan deities. When Matityahu saw this, he was filled with zeal and trembled with rage and let his anger rise, as was fitting. He ran and slew him upon the altar. So Matityahu sees this Jewish man about to bring a korban to a pagan deity, pulls out his sword, kills him right on the spot. He acted zealously for the sake of Torah, as Pinchas acted against Zimri, son of Salom, or Salu, right? Matityahu cried out throughout the town in a loud voice, "All who are zealous for the sake of the Torah, who uphold the covenant, march out after me. Mila Hashem Eli." Who does this sound like? Moshe Rabbeinu, right? So we have 2 stories that the books of the Maccabees are immediately praising. One is the Egel. They don't like the Egel part. They thought that the good guys were Shevet Levi, who conducted a massacre of 3,000 people right after the Egel. And similarly, they like Pinchas, who is famed, among other things, for that uncanny ability to take one spear and kill 2 people at one time, committing a terrible, atrocious act of sin in public. Okay. Now, I learned this story actually as a kid. Maybe you did also, right? That, you know, he killed the Jew who was going to worship idols, Mila Shem Eli, and he rallies the troops over that. And of course, at the time, that sounds like very heroic. And then at some point, you start thinking about, well, would I want my children to do that in a similar circumstance? Would I want my children to grow up seeing Jews acting inappropriately? God willing, by the time they grow up, all Jews will act appropriately. But until then, is that what we want to teach our children? Is this really a good role model lesson? Even, you know, we venerate the Maccabees on Hanukkah, or at least I think we do. And all of a sudden you start reading these stories, and it brings back the whole issue methodologically of how Chazal reckon with biblical stories, such as the Pinchas one. Some of them are easy. Abraham Avinu feeds his guests. Great. Let's make our nursery project with tents, and let's talk about it, and let's invite people over, have a hospitality Shabbaton. That's easy. When you get to Parashat Pinchas, what are our options if we're Chazal or later rabbinic thinkers trying to derive religious meaning from the text? You have two choices, basically. God approved. How do I know? Because God said so in the Torah. God shows up after the whole event, says, great job, Pinchas. You get brief kehunat olam. God's praise is pretty good haskamah, even in these troubled times. And so, we know that what Pinchas did was met with divine approval. So here are our options if we're Chazal. Either, just like Pinchas did this and God approved, so too we all should do the same thing. That's one approach. The other approach is, Pinchas was an unbelievably saintly individual whose motive was absolutely pure. And how do I know that his motives were absolutely pure? Because God showed up and said so. But if God isn't going to show up and say so, then you know what? Don't spear people. Even if they're doing the wrong thing. Even if you're sure that they're doing the wrong thing, and even if you really somehow think that you're pure. But don't go out there killing people just because they're doing the wrong thing. Chazal have to grapple with that sort of thing. And so did the Maccabees. The Maccabees read the Pinchas story, and it's very clear from source number one over here, they saw Pinchas' act as one that should be emulated by righteous individuals. You see Jews violating the Torah in a major way, go out there and if need be, kill them. And act violently and zealously toward them. And in fact, on his deathbed, Matityahu made sure that his children knew this in source number two, later in the same chapter. And the time drew near for Matityahu to die. He said to his sons, my children, be zealous for the Torah and be ready to give your lives for the covenant of our fathers. Pinchas, our ancestor, through his active zeal, received a pact of priesthood for all time. Matityahu is saying his last will and testament, his spiritual legacy to his children, the Maccabees, our heroes, is if you see Jews violating the Torah, go out there and get them. Interesting. Pinchas becomes the role model for the whole Maccabean family, and in this source we learn not only is he a role model, but he is the ancestor of the Maccabees, at least according to their tradition. What do we do with that? I don't know. I'm very queasy. Sorry, I don't feel so comfortable saying, yeah, what a great idea. Let's all emulate the Maccabees and kill not religious Jews who violate the Torah in some egregious manner. I'm not the first person to be queasy. I'm sure some of you might also feel similarly, that there's something weird about this. Chazal really struggled with the Pinchas thing. Maccabees did not struggle. For them, we must be like our ancestor Pinchas. One of the most colorful and beautiful ways of describing Chazal's feelings on this, you go to the Yerushalmi in source number 3. Upinachas, Shalobirtan Chachamim Amar, Shalobirtan Chachamim. Pinchas did not act in accordance with the sages. Rabbi Yudah ben Pazi said, the sages wanted to excommunicate him, were it not for the divine spirit that jumped in and said that he and his descendants shall have an eternal covenant of priesthood. Wow. Think about what Chazal are doing here. They're reading a biblical story of Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Killed the bad guys. God comes and approves. And their response here is, Pinchas did not act in accordance with the sages. They picture that they're standing there on the desert floor, watching this all go down. And the sages wanted to excommunicate him. Rav Yudah ben Pazi here is saying that, imagine that we were there. What would we do? We would have put Pinchas in Cherem. But then we would have had to retract, because then God showed up and said it was okay. What are Chazal doing here? They're struggling. They don't like the story. There's clear discomfort here. They cannot disapprove of Pinchas himself, because God approved of Pinchas. But they can disapprove of that action for us. They don't want us to be like Pinchas. In fact, Hillel picked a different role model for us, right? In source number 4, Hillel v'shamaki blumehem, Hillel omer, Hebe mitami davshel Aharon, Ohev shalom bro dev shalom, Ohevet abriyadim karavan la Torah. That's a very different model from be like Pinchas, truly zealous for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and if need be, kill the bad guys, meaning bad Jews, who are not fulfilling the Torah properly. Hillel is suggesting a different path. Let's go for not Pinchas, the grandson, but rather Aharon, the grandfather. This is a very different model. Maybe what's going on here, and maybe why Chazal were so uncomfortable with the books of the Maccabees, is that they didn't want to codify this. If the books of the Maccabees would have appeared in Tanakh, you and I would learn it with Rashi and all the later Mefarshim, because all the Mefarshim would gravitate to it the same way that they gravitate to the other books in Tanakh. We would see them as eternal, divinely inspired messages that we need to apply in our own lives. And all of a sudden, we would have no choice but to be a good religious Jews. We would have to become religious zealots. Chazal say no. The purest of the pure, real Pinchas, can be that zealot. The rest of us, don't even think about it. And think about the Haftarah that Chazal chose for us, for Chanukah. When you think about it, it's nuts. You know what they could have chosen? And by the way, there's one midrash in Sfikta Rabati, chapter 4, that does choose this Haftarah. We don't do it. What would be an excellent prophetic passage to reflect Chanukah? Well, I'll tell you what Sfikta Rabati picks. They say, why don't we just read Eliyahu at Har HaCarmel? Where Eliyahu took on the entire Baal establishment, meaning Israelites who were worshipping Baal, had the big showdown on Har HaCarmel. Fire came from heaven and consumed Eliyahu's sacrifice. Eliyahu then conducted a massacre of the Baal prophets. And at least for that day, everybody said, Hashem hu Elohim, Hashem hu Elohim. That's the proposed Haftarah in Sikha Rabati, and there's no doubt in my mind that's the Haftarah that the Maccabees themselves would have chosen in their shul. Because that reflects a clear continuity from, when do we read that Haftarah, by the way? Well, we read the chapter after that for Pinchas, but on Ki Tisa, the Parashat the Egel, we read Eliyahu Har Carmel, and then we read the continuation of that Pinchas. So very good. So it's also Eliyahu. So there's a continuation. What we see is Eliyahu is a continuation of the Egel. Moshe Rabbeinu took on the Egel, defeated the key perpetrators. Eliyahu Anavi at Har Carmel takes on the key perpetrators. The question is, does that extend to the Maccabees? If you read that Haftarah, you're saying, yeah, the Maccabees are part of that family of great religious zealots who killed Israelites who were sinning. And what did we choose instead? What did Chazal pick for us? Zechariah chapters 3 and 4, look at the highlight in source number 5 over here. Are you kidding me? You think this was an accident? Look what they chose. And look how we talk and look how we all read on Chanukah. Vayomer Elai, Ma Ata Ro'eh? Zechariah envisions a menorah being fed with olive oil, which is the symbol is that Zerubbabel and Yehoshua are supplying oil for God's presence. And God then says, Vayan vayomer Eli lemor, Zedvar Hashem el Zerubbabel lemor, lo bechayo velo bechoach. It's not through great military victories, ki imruchi amar Hashem tzvakot. We're not going to triumph through military might, but rather through God's Spirit. Why did Chazal pick this as a Haftarah for the Maccabees? After all, the Maccabees, they won a war, didn't they? Isn't that the point? Isn't that what Chazal don't want us to make the point? Maybe Chazal are steering us very loud and clear away from, if we would have read Eliyahu at Har HaCarmel, again, that would be a vindication of the Maccabees. Chazal didn't want that. Chazal are making a break and saying the Maccabean zealotry is too much, and that we want to be like Aharon and not like Pinchas. You know, in the books of the Maccabees, there are tons and tons of miracles, like really cool ones. You should read it. You should read it. There's some really cool miracles in there. And clearly the point within the context of the books of the Maccabees is twofold. One, whenever you have miracles in a biblical sounding book, it's to glorify God. And the other part of it is to justify the Maccabean acts. Obviously, if the Maccabees are acting in a certain way and they're getting flooded with divine health and miracles, well, that means that God approves. That's the point. Well, Chazal just talked about one miracle on Chanukah, which is, of course, good old oil lasting for a long time. You know, for all those miracles that are in the books of the Maccabees, that one's not there. Not in any of the four books. Interesting. Chazal go out of their way almost to focus on a miracle, a great miracle indeed, one that we like very much, but one that the Maccabees didn't focus on. It's really curious. Because the Maccabees had their approach. Look at all these miracles that we got. Chazal said we're ignoring all of those, and we're going to base our holiday on one miracle that you don't even talk about. Seems like Chazal, once again, are breaking rank with the Maccabees. They've chosen a different Haftarah for us, again, despite the fact that there was one Midrashic view to pick Eliyahu at Har HaKarmel. It seems like Chazal, very much near the time of the Maccabees, wanted to create a much gentler form of the holiday, one that focuses on what are our highlights. Hidur Mitzvah, Lo b'chaya v'lo b'cha ki'im b'ruchi. It's a very gentle holiday in Chazal's mind. They want very much to steer away from the miracle and to focus on pure spirituality and pure beautification of mitzvot. Chazal did something very grand for us. They took us away from this religious zealotry. And even Pinchas, Chazal discussed at great length the whole idea of Haboel Aramis. We have this idea of Kana'im Togi'imbo. It's on the books. Since Pinchas did something, it must have been okay. And so, you look at the laws in Masechet Sanhedrin, and you see how much Chazal completely circumscribed them, so it's virtually impossible to live the zealous life that Pinchas did, because, of course, Pinchas was so pure. So, yeah.
Chazal also got a great change, though, to try to minimize the approach of Hillel and Pinchas, because Pinchas is Ben Aaron, which is Rode Shalom, they point that out, and also, what was the bris that Rabban Shalom gave? It was one of Shalom. Also, in the original text that you read in the Matis Yehu's action, it doesn't seem like it was a premeditated approach. In other words, this was something his anger rose and he acted zealously.
Right.
So this wasn't something that they had taken as an official approach. So zealous by definition, I think, has to be unofficial.
Right, you're thinking very chazalically, and good for you. We all should be thinking very chazalically. But look at source number 2 that we also read together, where he says that his last will and testament, he prescribes it. Now, he's saying, this is the right way to go. We should always teach our children to act that way. It's very different from the moment of passion that you see in source number 1, which could have been viewed as just like Pinchas. Now, that night, what did Pinchas tell his children? That's a good question. So the Maccabees have an answer. They say, he told them, you should do exactly what I did. Hillel is saying, no, be like Aharon. I think that there's a very clear move that Chazal are trying to get us away from this religious zealotry. But see, the funny thing is that in the medieval period, when poor Jews, and the Jews have always been persecuted and running from country to country, and very often we feel very weak and despondent. And one of those few role models that we ever had in history ever was the Maccabees. Here's a group of Jews who they didn't just fight the assimilationists. They took on the whole, they took on the Syrian Greeks. And they won. So the fact that Chazal completely downgraded that side of the equation, focus on spirituality and Hidur Mitzvah, uplifts our holiday, but it took away something that we actually needed at times of trouble. So all of a sudden, what happens in the medieval period? The rabbis decide, we have to revive the military side. We've gotten away from the zealotry, but we still need to look to sources of strength within our tradition. And all of a sudden, the Avah Nissim prayer comes into play. And all of a sudden, there's this wacky book that you can get at like YU Chanukah dinners for free on your way out of the coat check, but it was written in the medieval period also, called Megillat Antiochus, where some Jews got together, looked at the books of the Maccabees, made a nice, frumified version of it, and got it out there just to let people know about the story of the Maccabees, that the military side could be celebrated also. That song, Ma'oz Tzur, that we all know and love and sing, and it's all about how God should triumph over our enemies just as he has in the past. Well, it likewise celebrates strength in times of trouble and persecution. That also is from the medieval period. The medieval rabbis weren't satisfied with a purely spiritual, ethereal, Hidur Mitzvah, Ali Makodesh Ve'en Moridin sort of holiday. We needed to have that source of strength also. We lost some self-esteem by completely cutting off the Maccabees. So the Maccabees were completely reworked into, let's leave out the religious zealotry parts and let's focus on the fact that we beat off our enemies. Well, that was something that felt very good in the medieval period and something that came back. That's another layer of our tradition that, of course, we celebrate and consider very important, and it's made it into the tefillah. Modern Zionism kind of got it wrong by simply cutting out the God thing and leaving it all in the hands of military heroism. In other words, they picked up on the medieval move toward, let's venerate the Maccabees, but focusing exclusively on the Maccabean strength rather than on the religious side. That's obviously taking the spectrum quite a little bit too far. What I wanted to get at here in this part of the shiur is just, Chazal may have just dismissed the Maccabees because the Maccabees themselves, their grandchildren, became Hellenists. But it could very well be that Chazal needed to keep the Maccabees completely cut down because they, while very religious and while they did many good things, the religious zealotry was not something that Chazal wanted to perpetuate in any normative manner, and so they completely shut them down, made the holiday a very gentle one. And it was only in the medieval period that we revived the militaristic side of the holiday. So that's phase number one of the shiur. So that's one thing that we could learn from looking at the books of the Maccabees, and then looking back through our normative tradition, through Chazal and the Rishonim, and we could see very much what is in Chazal, and what Chazal very deliberately steered us away from. Here's another thing, you know, you and I might be saying things like Chanukah Sameach to each other in a couple of weeks. Anybody here have Israeli friends? When you talk to your Israeli friends, what do they wish you? They always say Chag Urim Sameach, and they find that very cute, right? They like that one. Chag Urim, Happy Festival of Lights. Now, Josephus already referred to this Festival of Lights. He said, you know, Chanukah is sometimes also called Festival of Lights. Now, why is it called Festival of Lights?
No.
True, yeah, that's what I thought too. Josephus, a couple thousand years ago, writes, Chanukah, some people call it Chag HaUrim, but I don't know why. What do you mean you don't know why? Just light your menorah, there's some lights and festival about it. You know, it's easy. Right? That's what I always thought it was. I thought Chag HaUrim was just a nice nickname to the Chanukiah part of the story. Well, Josephus didn't think so, and he lived a long time ago. So that's weird. So that's question number one that comes up. Here's another interesting question. You know, the reason why we light the Chanukiah, it's going to sound really strange and silly, but hey, that's what fun questions are all about sometimes. We're commemorating the fact that the Maccabees rededicated the Beit HaMikdash and lit the menorah, right? All right, now, here's a multiple choice question, okay? When was the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash lit? Daytime or nighttime? This was daytime. They never lit it at night. So why don't we light our Chanukiah in the day? If we're going to commemorate the rededication of the menorah and the Maccabees and the Kohanim, they got that one little cruse of oil and they light the menorah. Of course they lit it during the daytime. So why don't we just do the same thing? So presuming it's not very good. The answer is that you can all see better when you light it at night than when you light it during the day. And of course that is correct, and I'm not going to dismiss that answer. Of course that is right. But all the same, if it's a festival, if we're trying to commemorate something, it's at least important to raise the question. For example, if you wanted to make a Pirsumei Nisa, you could light it at the right time, namely daytime, and then come up, you know, put up a sign, Happy Chanukah. Or even, Nes Gadol Hayasham. Or so, we come up with some other way of publicizing the miracle at night when people can see it. And once again, why do Chazal emphasize the miracle of the oil almost to the exclusion of, they mention the victory, but only very much in passing. Why do they emphasize so much the miracle of the oil? And here's the biggest question of them all. This is a really doozy one. Ever read Megillat Ta'anit? Megillat Ta'anit goes, we have a hand. Okay, there we go. Megillat Ta'anit is really also a really cool historical document. It goes back to the Tanaim, and it goes back, and it records all these different Yamim Tovim, or pseudo Yamim Tovim, semi-holidays that they observed in the Second Temple period for this reason, and that reason, and this reason, and that reason. And most of the holidays that they used to keep back then, in the good old days, we don't keep now. You know why? Because the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, unfortunately. Right? So all of these holidays of doing something good for the Beit HaMikdash simply become irrelevant once there is no more Beit HaMikdash. All right, so here's the toughy question of the evening, and don't change your holiday plans as a result of this question. Why do we keep Chanukah at all? After all, if we're celebrating the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash, that's fantastic, as long as the Beit HaMikdash is there. But once there is no Beit HaMikdash, I understand why we're so mournful about it on Tisha B'Av and all the other times that we do that. It's horrendous that we've lost the Beit HaMikdash. But given that it's not there, why celebrate the rededication of a non-existent building? Now, I didn't make up any of these questions. This is straight out of Rav Yehuda Nun's article from 1990 in Megadim. And when he asked those questions, yeah.
Perhaps we're not celebrating the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash, we're celebrating God's previous sale of the miracles that he did for us.
Oh, very good.
We have to celebrate miracles.
Yes. Yes. So Rav Yehuda ben Nun has a more comprehensive theory that incorporates your point and several others along the way. He says that the reason why we're so confused by the Chag HaOrim thing, and it's strange that we light the menorah or the Chanukiah at night, given that the whole point is that they lit the menorah during the day, and why do we celebrate Chanukah at all? He says that actually we're missing a very important layer, which is in the Gemara. This is not even in the Book of the Maccabees. This is just in the Gemara. Go back to a Calvin and Hobbes, where this is, that part's not in the Gemara, this is in the apocryphal version. Go back to a Calvin and Hobbes. I don't know if Watterson knew the Gemara, but he, it's certainly in the right spirit of the Gemara, where Calvin notices that the days are getting shorter and therefore decides that the world must be coming to an end, and then at some point he finds out that it's just good old nature, right? So long before Calvin figured this out, wise little six-year-old boy that he is, Adam HaRishon had this problem according to the Gemara. In source number 6, Terach Hanan Bar Rabba, Kalenda is kept on the eight days following the winter equinox, and Saturnalia on the 8 days preceding the equinox. This is Masechet Avodah Zarah that focuses on pagan things that we can understand. So these are two pagan holidays, specifically right around the time of Chanukah. Our rabbis taught, when Adam HaRishon saw the day getting gradually shorter, he said, "Woe is me, perhaps because I have sinned. The world around me is being darkened and returning to its state of chaos and confusion." He thought the world was going back to Tohu Vavohu, very much anticipating what Calvin would eventually say. So Adam HaRishon likewise was concerned about the days getting shorter. "This then is the kind of death to which I have been sentenced from heaven." So he began keeping an 8 days fast. But as he observed the winter equinox and noted the day getting increasingly longer, he said, "This is the world's course. Ah, Baruch Hashem, it's nature. This is just the way it works." And he set forth to keep an 8 days festivity. In the following year, he appointed both as festivals. Now, he fixed them for the sake of heaven, but those heathens, heathens really get in the way of a lot of good things. The heathens appointed them for the sake of idolatry. All right. When is Chanukah? Starts on Kav Hei Kislev, which is right when the moon is really tiny, in the shortest days of the year, darkest time of the winter. And it goes either, it's a cool variable point, right? It's the old Gimel Teves. Some years it is Chanukah, some years it's not, depending on whether Rosh Chodesh is 1 day or 2 days long. I like that. But in the meantime, this is the darkest part of the year. And what this Gemara is saying is that the Festival of Lights has nothing to do with Chanukah. Right? That's why Josephus didn't know. He didn't know this Gemara. The Festival of Lights goes back, according to this Gemara, to Adam HaRishon. That when he first encountered this dark season of the year, he thought, oh no, the world is coming to an end. And only when the day started getting a little bit longer and brighter and the moon started getting bigger again, he realized, oh, Baruch Hashem, this is just it's part of the cycle of nature. He felt much better about the whole thing and instituted monotheistic holidays. Unfortunately, the pagans got it wrong and turned it into pagan festivals of light. But it's all these 8 days, by the way. Why is Hanukkah 8 days long? Well, in this reading, Chanukah is 8 days long because there was a holiday long before any Maccabee ever existed that was 8 days long. And Chanukah is a historical layer being added to something else. Further, Rav Yehuda ben Nun notes from the Mishnah in Bikurim, Chanukah is actually, halakhically, the end of the olive harvest. And it has Bikurim status, right? Source number 7 over here. Now, Tarivad Echad, means, you know, from Shavuot until Sukkot, Evi Vikore, it talks about Parashat Bikurim when you read the confession, if you bring your Bikurim during these windows of time. Min Hechad Ve'ad Chanukah Mevi Ve'no Kore. If you bring your produce from Sukkot until Chanukah, this is the end of the agricultural cycle. Then you bring the Bikurim, but you don't recite the confessional that's in Devarim Perikavav. Rabbi Yudah ben Matera Omer Mevi Vikore. No, you should bring it and also read this Vidui. Okay. What matters to us is that, again, if Chanukah is part of Israel's agricultural cycle with the olive harvest, well, that also predates any Maccabees, doesn't it? In other words, the harvest cycle part didn't change at all. Something else is going on. So Rav Yehuda ben Nun points out that's at least theoretically possible, based on this Gemara and based on the Mishnah Bikurim, that B'nai Yisrael may have observed an 8-day festival of lights during Bayit Rishon. There's no reason why not. We don't have any record that they did, but there's no reason why that could not have happened, because after all, we would be celebrating God's control and power over nature and God's control and power over the agricultural cycle. These are perfectly good monotheistic things to do. And of course, the pagans, those pesky pagans, as the Gemara points out, they're trying to promote a pagan festival where they celebrate and venerate their deities instead. Curiously, zinging over to our Book of Maccabees again, you'll find a remarkable corroboration. Why do we observe Kaf Hei Kislev as the beginning of Hanukkah? Well, we know the answer to that one. That's when we won, right? We won and we rededicated the Beit HaMikdash on the 25th of Kislev. But what you find out from the Book of the Maccabees is that that's also the date that the Greeks desecrated the temple a few years earlier. And that the Maccabees went out of their way to dedicate it to undo the damage that the Greeks had done. It's not just, by the way, we won on Kaf Dalet, found that oil and lit it the next day. We actually cared about Kaf Hei before the Maccabean victory, and that's sources 8 and 9. On the 15th day of Kislev, the king had an abomination of desolation built upon the altar, as on the 25th day of the month. They would offer sacrifices on the illicit altar, which was upon the temple altar. So here we see on the 25th day of Kislev, the Greeks began sacrificing on this pagan shrine. Why would they choose that day? Could be that was the first day it was available, but Rav Yehiel ben Nun argues no. They're making an argument against, it's a battle over who the festivals of lights venerates. The Greeks' whole point was that we should have one unified religion, specifically Hellenistic religion and culture, and everybody, specifically us Jews, should join them. And they were imposing their will onto us. And so they said, festival of lights isn't to serve your God, it's to serve our deities. And then the Maccabees come back when they win in source number 9, when they win the war. They rose early on the morning on the 25th day of the 9th month, that is the month of Kislev, and they brought a sacrifice according to the Torah upon the new altar of burnt offerings which they had built, at the very time of year and on the very day on which the Gentiles had profaned the altar. Maccabees understand all too well, Kaf Hei Kislev was the antidote to something that had happened Kaf Hei Kislev just 3 years prior, when the temple in the Beit HaMikdash was first desecrated. Let's put all of this together. The Festival of Lights long predates the Maccabees. The olive harvest long predates the Maccabees. So the point is that the Maccabean victory is an historical overlay onto something that already was there. It gives it new meaning, lavdil, but not so lavdil, the same thing as Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. Those are agricultural holidays in Israel as well. And then the Torah obviously gives entirely new meaning based on historical events of great formative significance. Specifically, Yitzhak, Mitzrayim, Matan, Torah, and Israel's experience in the wilderness. But the harvest season was there before. The harvest season is just, that's when things grow and that's when things are harvested in Israel. The Torah sanctifies these agricultural dates. And so too, the Maccabees now, and Chanukah itself, sanctify with a historical meaning this Festival of Lights and this agricultural cycle. And if you accept that theory, which I find very persuasive, I think Rav Yehiel ben Nun did a fabulous job here, this explains everything. It explains why the holiday is 8 days long. Namely, the holiday was 8 days long before there was ever such thing as the word Maccabee. Right? It's not because, let's figure out what one day is not miraculous, the other seven are. There's nothing at all to do with that. It was an 8-day holiday before. Number two, it explains why we light at night. Because the Festival of Lights is when you lit things at night. Again, you would light for the Festival of Lights long before there was Chanukah. We've built in now the meaning of Pirsumei Nisan. There's no question that we have joined the Maccabean victory and the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash to this pre-existing holiday of the Festival of Lights. It also explains why we celebrate the holiday even after Churban Bayit Sheni. We've been celebrating it for a long time as a very beloved holiday. Because even though we can't appreciate as much the rededication of a Beit HaMikdash that's not there, we certainly can appreciate God's power over nature and over nature and His Hashgacha. That's something that we celebrate all the time, and that's ultimately what the meaning of Chanukah is at its root. And all of a sudden, Chazal's emphasis not on the military victory of the Maccabees, but on the miracle of olive oil, that's really close to what the holiday always has been. Chazal are very much the original meaning of the holiday. In other words, here we are, olive oil, olive harvest, and here we are celebrating God's power over the world. Chazal exactly are completely in touch with the original layers of the holiday, and the Maccabees is actually, that's the later meaning of the holiday. It's a significant one, and one that has taken on some other meanings as we have seen. That's the second dimension of Chanukah, and I think understanding something about the book of Maccabees really helps you get to the roots of how things started, and then where Chazal come in with it, what became normative Judaism, and I think that's very important for us in our own normative Jewish lives to understand these different layers. Rabbi Gershon Kitzis, in a journal called Jewish Thought, which no longer exists, well, this issue I guess still exists because it was published and it's out there somewhere in a library, but it has ceased publishing new issues. How about that? So in the inaugural issue of Jewish Thought, I believe, either it was the first or second, no, that first one, correct, back in 1990, he offered yet another dimension that one could get out of the book of the Maccabees. Source number 10 over here. On the very same date on which the temple was profaned by foreigners, occurred the purification of the temple on the 25th of the ninth month, that is Kislev. Joyfully they held an eight-day celebration after the pattern of Sukkot, remembering how just a short time before they had spent the festival of Sukkot like wild beasts in the mountains and in the caves. Therefore, holding wreathed wands and branches bearing ripe fruit and palm fronds, they offered songs of praise to him who had victoriously brought about the purification of his place. By vote of the commonwealth, they decreed a rule for the entire nation of the Jews to observe these days annually. Well, here's another reason why it's 8 days long, right? Because they were just copying Sukkot. You know, it's kind of nice that Thanksgiving and Chanukah coincide for so many reasons. They both are Sukkot-modeled holidays, even though, of course, they have very different meanings for so many different reasons. They're both very important holidays in their own right, in different ways. But the Maccabees themselves understand the eight-day holiday thing is because they missed Sukkot because they were busy fighting. So now they're saying, well, now we have to kind of have a rain check. We're doing Sukkot all over again, albeit in Kislev rather than in its proper time. It really ties together our series really nicely in terms of the timing. We started right after Sukkot, and here we are very shortly before Chanukah. So Gershon Kitzis points out that once you realize that the Maccabees understand that Chanukah and Sukkot are very deeply linked, you begin to understand all kinds of passages in Halachot in the Gemara that you might not have appreciated as much. For example, this doesn't affect you so much, but we apartment-dwelling folk, well, you know, we Orthodox Jews like to pick low floors while everybody else likes the high floors just because of Shabbat, right? But another once-a-year bonus of having a low floor is that typically our apartments are below 20 amot, which is the maximum height of Pirsumei Nisab. If you live way up there, oh man, first of all, you have to worry about the elevator every week, but you also have to worry about Pirsumei Nisab. You're so way high up there, you're above the limit. What else is a 20 amma maximum? A sukkah. Oh, how about that? Right? Maybe that's not an accident, right? That a sukkah maximum height is 20 amot. The fear is after that the shade starts coming from the walls rather than from the sukkah. That's the fear in that particular case, but it's the same height. Here's another good one. The two holidays of all time that focus on Hidur Mitzvah more than any other one are, well, it'd be hard to guess this one, I'm sure, but lo and behold, the two holidays that we focus on Hidur Mitzvah way more than any other, Hidur Mitzvah is always a good thing, but certainly Sukkot and Chanukah get the most. And the best part of the whole thing is, you know, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai argue about the Chanukah candles, what direction we're supposed to go, right? 1 to 8 or 8 to 1. So Hillel wins, that's always good. Well, but Shammai, Beit Shammai's team thought that it should go 8 on the first day, 7 on, you know, 7 on the next one, and so on down to 1. And what was his model? Why did he? Korbanot of Sukkot, Keneged Pare Echad. He said, look, on Sukkot there's a descending order of sacrifices, 13, 12, 11. So, what's Sukkot got to do with Chanukah? The answer is everything. And so Beit Shammai, again, just living a couple centuries after that, even though Chazal never talk about this link, because they're banning the books of the Maccabees, but they knew about this stuff, and it seems very much that they modeled Chanukah after Sukkot, because they understood that there was a very deep link. But of course, until you know this link from the Maccabees, you don't understand why Chazal are making these particular connections so prominently, but there's a very good reason for all of that. That is yet a third dimension of what we can get in terms of deepening our own understanding of our tradition, what we actually do from Chazal and from our Mefarshim, but we understand it much better once we look through the books of the Maccabees. So those are three points that I thought were worthwhile for you tonight, and I like them very much. My Chanukah is completely transformed as a result of preparing the Shiur. It's a whole different understanding of what it should be. More globally now, this is just an interesting point, and with this I'll wind down. Chazal want, you know, part of training faith, it's interesting what faith is. Rav Mordechai Breuer had a very good definition of faith. Some people think that, you know, grand miracles build faith, but of course the Torah teaches you time and again, boy does that not work, right? You know, right after Kriyat Yam Suf and Matan Torah, you still get your task and you still have all the whining and all of that. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows full well that big grand events don't do it, it's the day to day, right? And those great speeches for all the Bar Mitzvah kids and all of that that we all do. But in the meantime, it's very true. But another thing that faith does, and this is what Rav Mordechai Breuer I think says very poignantly, is that it gives us a lens through which we see the entire world. So for example, if you don't have that faith lens, you could read Sefer Shofetim and you could read Sefer Maccabim and you read them as the same. Here are two works written in ancient Israel for a particular thing. But of course our Emunah has trained us very strongly. Sefer Shofetim is Nivuah, it's glowing with prophecy. And the books of the Maccabees, we didn't even hear about them practically until more recently, it's so easily available. But when we read them, we're not reading them with the same eyes. And it's really thanks to Chazal that we have this very clear sense of what is in part of our canon, part of our tradition, and what is not. We see this very dramatically in sources 12 and 13. Kol Yisrael Yeshlem Chelek Olam Haba. Mishnah Sanhedrin starts off very upbeat, and then of course it devolves into the harsh stuff, right? Shneimar v'amechulam tzadikim olam Yeshua Sneitzer Matai Maaseh Adai Lehitpa'er, which is how you begin, you know, Perkei Avot or this and that, and then you leave out the stuff that comes right after, which is Ve'elu She'en Lahem Chelek Olam Haba. Here are the people who lose their share in the world to come. Ha'amer Ein Tchiyat HaMeitim Min HaTorah, those who deny resurrection in the Torah. Bein Torah Min HaShemayim, those who deny the revelation. Vapi Koris, there's plenty of discussion in the Gemara about what that is. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Afa Koreh B'Sfarim HaChitoniim, one who reads external books. Well, what are external books? So the Yerushalmi clarifies that. Rabbi Akiva Omer, source 13 now. Afa Koreh B'Sfarim HaChitoniim, Tegon Sifurei Ben Sirav Sifrei Ben La'ana. These are apocryphal works. I don't know what Ben La'ana or Ben La'aga is, but Ben Sira is, it sounds like Sefer Mishlei, and in fact Chazal liked it. They quoted it about a dozen times throughout Shas. But this Yerushalmi is saying that apocryphal works are part of this Sfarim Chitoniyim. Aval, Sifrei Hemiras, Homer, the Chol Sfarim Shenechtevu Mikan V'Helach, and other works that were written after that, HaKorei Bahem KiKorei BaYigaret. If you read them, that's fine. There's no problem with reading Homer. There's a problem with reading the what we call the Apocrypha, the books that wanted to be part of Tanakh but were excluded by Chazal. That was the real problem. Dr. Sid Lyman, in his book, The Canonization of Hebrew Scripture, it's a wonderful book and an incredibly important resource, when it says, when Rabbi Akiva is objecting to somebody reading Ben Sira or reading apocryphal books, what does read mean? Two options. One is read in your living room, or two is read publicly as a synagogue reading. It's a big difference, right? If you say it means you can't even read it in your living room, that means just don't touch these books, they're terrible. If it means don't read them in synagogues, that means you don't want it to look from a synagogue service that this is Kodesh, but you can still read it in your living room, that's fine. You can read it like you could read Homer. That's the machloket mefarshim from time immemorial about what Rabbi Akiva meant. Was he banning looking at apocryphal works, the books that we call the books of the Apocrypha, or was he banning just public synagogue readings? Regardless of what he did, it's very clear that the prohibition was relaxed in the sense that people reading it today, I don't think, are doing anything wrong. But we still obviously, we don't even have a Hava, you know, we can't imagine reading it in synagogues. But at the time of Rabbi Akiva, the fear was if you read it in synagogues, people will think it's part of Tanakh. And that would be a disaster, because Chazal very much wanted us to understand what is or is not part of our tradition. And this is all what I'm driving at in terms of Chazal shaped what our faith is. Chazal really shaped what we look at as glowing with Ruach HaKodesh, glowing with Nivuah, and those things which are other books. And at the time when the apocryphal books were written, including the books of the Maccabees, there was a fear of Chazal that Jews would read them and sincerely believe these are divinely inspired and therefore binding on our faith the way that the other Sfarim that we have been looking at. So it's a good, you know, rounding up the point in terms of how we look at the books of the Maccabees as external and how important that is. To wind this all down, even though the books of the Maccabees were never part of our canon, we can see how much we could learn from them. I think it's incredibly important to understanding all kinds of Chazals, all kinds of later aspects of our halachic tradition, based on what we see rooted in the Maccabees and what we see deviating from the Maccabees and shaping the way Chazal wanted us to observe the holiday. I think the books of the Maccabees teach us how important it is to separate between Kodesh and Chol, that not all books are created equal. It's very much that our tradition wants us to view certain books with a certain pair of glasses and certain books either not at all or at the very least without it. And I wanted to conclude with my favorite passage that I found in the book of the Maccabees. I love this one. You know, whatever happens to the Aron HaKodesh, whatever happens to the Ark, the answer that we never want to think about, and thankfully I don't think it exists anywhere in Chazal, is maybe it was destroyed with the Beit HaMikdash. It's a possibility. Bayit Rishon was burned down. Maybe it was destroyed with it. Right? So we don't like that possibility, and Chazal don't even entertain that as one of the options. The leading options that you'll find in Masechet Yoma is either Yoshiyahu already got it out of there before the Churban, because he saw the Churban coming, and buried it somewhere in Har HaBayit, which is where I hope it is, because A, it's close and convenient, and B, even though it's very hard to access these days for assorted political reasons, it would be nice to know that it's very close to home, that when the time is right, we can get it out of there and bring it back to where it belongs. If it went to Babylonian exile, which is another possibility in the Gemara, so then, of course, once it was exiled there, it could have been exiled to other places, and that's where Indiana Jones, of course, gets off the ground, is following that Shemitah within the Gemara, although, again, I question whether or not they were exploring the Gemara. But I thought the most poetic answer ever given to this question is not found anywhere in Chazal, but it does appear in the second book of Maccabees in source number 15. In our documents, we find that it was Jeremiah the prophet, on receiving a divine revelation, ordered that the tabernacle and ark should go with him. So Yirmiyahu, at the time of the Qurban, gets this nevuah. It went on to say that Jeremiah went out to the mountain which Moses ascended to see the heritage promised by God. According to this tradition that the Maccabees record, HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed Yirmiyahu HaNavi where Moshe Rabbeinu was buried. There Yirmiyahu found a safe chamber and brought it into the tabernacle and the ark and the incense altar and blocked up the entrance. Some of those who had come along went back to mark the path, but they could not find it. When Yirmiyahu found out, he rebuked them, saying, "The place will remain unknown until God gathers his people together in the age of mercy. At that time the Lord will bring these things to light again, and the glory of the Lord and the cloud will be seen, as they were seen over Moshe and Ashlamo, too requested, in order that the place should be greatly sanctified." According to this passage and tradition that occurs in the book of the Maccabees, the Aron HaKodesh is with Moshe Rabbeinu. I think that's very beautiful. I like it better in Har HaBayit, just logistically. I like that better. But if it's not in Har HaBayit, this is my next favorite place for it to be in the theoretical sense. It's very beautiful. Yirmiyahu Navi got revealed to him where Moshe Rabbeinu's Tever is, just so he could bring it back to, of course, the source, the one who brought it to us in the first place. What I like about the source, other than it just adds another dimension to a very interesting discussion, is that it teaches that sometimes our greatest buried treasures are right there, you know, right there. And sometimes it just takes a little bit of learning and exploration, and all of a sudden it opens up a wealth of knowledge, understanding, and a deeper understanding of what we actually do. And with that, I feel still very weird not having a Tanakh in front of me, but I couldn't, because Chazal rightly banished the books of the Maccabees from the Tanakh, which is why I cannot talk about it from a sacred standpoint. But I think learning about the books of the Maccabees helped us understand that which is sacred in our tradition, and that, of course, is what we intend to celebrate 10 days or so from now. So with that, I want to thank you all once again. It's been such a pleasure. I've been missing you the last 3 weeks. I look forward to learning with you in the future. Again, I want to thank Rabbi Hochberg, and I want to thank Avi Freilich for putting this all together, and all of you for coming out and making this such a good series. Thank you.